your brain on creativity.
When we have done neuroimaging or brain imaging studies on highly creative people, we see that they actually activate their brain in different patterns than people who are less creative. And the idea of the book is if we can mimic those activation patterns, we can enhance our own creativity.
That's Shelley Carson talking about her book, Your Creative Brain. And wouldn't you like to be more productive with your brain?
A lot of procrastination comes from your brain, and your brain thinking, oh my gosh, this task is going to be so big or so difficult or so onerous. But 5-minute chunks are so small that your brain can just go, you know what, it's only 5 minutes. No matter how obnoxious the task is, I can do 5 minutes on it. And so you find that most of your resistance gets eliminated, and you just get right into a flow and you start going.
That's Steve Robbins, creator and host of the Get It Done Guy podcast. We'll talk to him about his funny and useful book, Get It Done Guy's 9 Steps to Work Less and Do More. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Creativity seems to be such a mysterious quality. Even for those of us who consider ourselves creative, the wellsprings of imagination seem to lie in a hidden region within us, a place where ideas come of their own sweet will and turn shy if you try to force them out. But can creativity be taught like any skill? Can those of us who are less creative learn from those who have the knack? My guest Shelley Carson thinks so. In her book, Your Creative Brain, 7 Steps to Maximize Imagination, Productivity, and Innovation in Your Life, she examines new evidence from brain science that can help you get your creative juices flowing. Shelley Carson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Now, your book, Your Creative Brain, 7 Steps to Maximize Imagination, Productivity, and Innovation in Your Life, you say that creativity is a characteristic that we all share. How do you know that?
First of all, if you examine the brains of highly creative individuals and those of the rest of us, there really aren't differences. The brain is really a creativity machine. And all of us engage in creative activities every day. For instance, just having a conversation with another person is a creative act. If you think about creativity as being the ability to combine bits of information in novel and original ways that are somehow meaningful or useful, what is more creative than putting a sentence together, which we all can do?
Right. And now, but there are those of us who are more creative than others. How do you test for creativity?
There are a number of different tests that we do, depending on which aspect of creativity you're looking at. One of the most popular tests is called a divergent thinking task, in which you ask people to generate multiple answers to a particular prompt. So it might be give as many uses as you can think of for a brick. Or what would be the consequences if we had 3 arms instead of 2? And then you assess these answers on fluency, which is the number of responses people come up with, and originality, which is the statistical infrequency of their answers.
Is there a genetic component to creativity?
There does appear to be a genetic component, and several different candidate genes, and we can, now that we've identified the entire human genome, we can look at all of this. And one of the things that I think is interesting is that it seems that particular dopamine genes, dopamine transporter gene and a couple of the receptor genes for the neurotransmitter dopamine seem to be prevalent in highly creative people.
That's so interesting. I know a fair amount about ADD. Mm-hmm. As my listeners know, I have it. My son has it even more. And I've done a fair amount of thinking, even teaching about it. And what I have noticed is that I think people with ADD tend to be more creative than others. And there are also researchers that say ADD or some of the problems with ADD that dopamine. Problems in the dopamine transport system are involved. it's always seemed to me that the deficit has come with this one gift of creativity. Is there a connection here?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And I think a lot of it depends upon the combination of the distractibility is one of the big components, obviously, of ADHD. And it turns out that highly creative people are also more distractible. That is, they notice things outside of their particular realm of current concentration. When this is combined with a certain degree of intelligence, it does seem to promote creative idea generation.
Is that because people are making associations that there's less of a boundaries between different kinds of thoughts?
Right. I would say that there's probably what's called cognitive disinhibition, which means that more information that would ordinarily be filtered out of conscious awareness is making its way into the conscious workspace. And this can lead to distractibility, but it can also lead to a number of different elements that could be combined and recombined in novel or original ways to come up with creative ideas.
One question I had for Shelley Carson was whether how creative you are depends entirely on your genes or whether it can also be fostered by one's environment. In other words, how much is nature and how much nurture?
The more we know about genes, the more we're seeing that you are not the victim of your genes. You are not the result of your genes. Genes can influence behavior, but they don't cause behavior. And one of the reasons is that so many genes interact with each other and interact with environmental influences. So, for instance, if we're looking at intelligence, one of the big findings about intelligence is what's called an enriched environment. And this is important for creativity as well. Very, very young infants, when they're exposed to enriched environments that have lots of color and different shapes, different sounds, when they're exposed to the human face on a regular basis, these things enrich their environment and actually cause neural connections in the brain that lead to higher intelligence.
So now in your book, Shelley Carson, Your Creative Brain, you make a number of claims, some of which made a lot of sense to me and some of which I was quite surprised about. You say that improving your creativity can improve physical health. How's that?
Well, one of the things that has been demonstrated is that when you're engaged in creative work, it reduces stress. Stress, high levels of stress are associated with two big health factors. The first is reduced immune system functioning, and the second is coronary or heart disease. So by reducing stress, by being involved in creative activities where you're kind of in flow or in the zone, so to speak, you're reducing stress, and that is a benefit to physical health. In addition, if you think about different types of adjunct therapies, such as art therapy and music therapy, drama therapy and writing therapy, these are all used for people who are in states of depression or anxiety, again, as adjunct, not usually as the main type of therapy. But the reason that they're used is because involvement in creative activity elevates your mood and decreases anxiety.
And you know, my mother is 90 years old all her life, and she's the most creative person I think I've ever met. She was lifelong a modern dancer and choreographer, and when she could no longer do that, she became a visual artist. Then she suffered a fall, and for 2 years, she really couldn't do much of anything. And I noticed that she was really having a kind of cognitive decline, I have to say. And she was also quite depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And more recently, she's gone back to writing and drawing. And the cognitive deficits, you know, some of them are still there, but the really important ones seem to be gone. You know, she's making as much better sense of the world, I think, in some ways than she ever has, even though her short-term memory may not be so good. And she's not depressed. She's happier than she's ever been. Is there a connection?
I definitely think so. When you begin engaging in creative activity, Well, there's a couple of different mechanisms of action. First of all, it distracts, it occupies enough of your brain that you don't have attention left for worry and rumination and for depression. So it actually does lift your mood. But the second thing is, which you just alluded to a second ago, is the meaning-making aspect of engaging in creative activity. Whether you're writing or painting, or even flower arranging, somehow you're creating order out of chaos. And this can have broad meaning-making relevance to your life so that you kind of make sense out of things that are going on around you. Perhaps your mother is now able to make better sense out of her fall and out of what she went through when she wasn't able to create.
We're talking with Shelley Carson. Her book is Your Creative Brain, and the subtitle is 7 Steps to Maximize Imagination, Productivity, and Innovation in Your Life. So let's talk about these 7 steps. You have a Create Brain Sets model. I thought that was pretty cool, the way you were able to really, to put together the different ways in which the brain can be more creative and to make that acronym. What does that stand for?
Each letter in the word CREATE stands for one of the different brain activation states. And the whole gist of the book is this. When we have done neuroimaging or brain imaging studies on highly creative people, we see that they actually activate their brain in different patterns than people who are less creative. And the idea of the book is if we can mimic those activation patterns, we can enhance our own creativity. So the idea of the CREATE brain sets model, and I call them brain sets because they're basically the biological equivalent of mindsets. You know how when you're in a different mindset, sometimes it can affect the way you see the world. Well, different brain sets also affect your perception, the way you see things, and the way you go about solving problems. And these, what I've done is try to combine all of the information that we have on different brain activation patterns in highly creative people at different stages of the creative process.
So may I give myself as an example here? You have a test that people can actually take online, and it's in the book. I thought it was better than most of these self-reporting tests because it really went into a fair amount of depth. And I found that I like to, 1, absorb, and 2, connect. So explain those.
Okay, and it's really interesting, Francesca, because I could tell that about you almost immediately. So let's talk about these different brain sets. The connect brain set is a brain set in our brain activation pattern in which you generate multiple ideas to a specific prompt. So you're able to come up with a number of new ideas. One idea leads to another, leads to another. If you think of brainstorming, brainstorming is sort of a subset of what you can do when you're in the connect brain set mode. And the absorb brain set that you mentioned is sort of an open-minded brain set where you're just absorbing information non-judgmentally the way a sponge would absorb water. Again, this is a highly receptive state where you are non-judgmental. So people who spend most of their time in the absorb and connect brain sets usually are able to generate creative ideas fairly easily. Do you find that's the case for yourself?
Yeah.
Right. Do you have a little bit more trouble in the evaluate area where you have to judge the value of your ideas?
Actually, I did pretty good in the evaluate. I think I did. I'm trying to look now.
That's my problem. I'm not very good at evaluating. I would be a horrible movie critic because I love every movie I see, even the bad ones.
Oh, no, I did okay with the evaluate. I think there were some things that I didn't do so well with, but this is, that's so interesting. You took me aback when you said you figured it out right away. So talk about the evaluate. Is it, you're saying it's about being kind of critical then?
Well, being able to make snap judgments on very little information. So many people live, that's their comfort zone, their mental comfort zone, is they size things up really quickly. Now, this is good if you need to make rapid evaluations of an idea or of something that's in your environment that could be dangerous, it's not good for generating creative ideas. And the reason is that many ideas won't even make it into conscious awareness. If you're evaluating them, they won't make it through social filters, social appropriateness filters, silly filters, you know, things that are looking for, this is a bad idea. So that idea might not even make it into conscious awareness for you. You want to turn down the filters and allow more information in to consciousness. And to do that, you have to turn down the volume on the judgment centers of your brain.
That's so interesting. Now, I imagine it's something that could be taught. You know, I worked as a social worker, a crisis counselor, where I really got trained over the 4 years that I did it in making snap judgments, mm-hmm. because I had to do that. It wasn't really my normal way of functioning. I think you're right about that. So what are ways in which people can enhance, you know, if they fall down in some of these creates mindsets, brain sets, mm-hmm. what are some of the ways that they can enhance things that they might be a little weaker in?
Well, again, you have to identify which areas you're the weakest in. And then one of the things that I use, one of the techniques that I use in the book is you give yourself mild, these little rewards, tokens, whenever you complete an exercise. And you get double tokens if you complete exercises in brain sets that are uncomfortable for you. So for the evaluate brain set, there I have a number of exercises where you have to rank order different belongings, for instance, and with the idea that you're going to throw away, even just mentally throw away, the ideas or the objects that are lower on your ranking system. And this gives absorb people a lot of trouble because they are open to everything and they just don't want to make judgments. So by forcing yourself to make judgments, you can get better at it. And I'm sure that's part of how you were trained as well when you went through your social work training.
Yeah, I think so. Now, you also distinguish between deliberate and spontaneous pathways to creative mm-hmm. thought. I'm more spontaneous than deliberate. You probably know that already. tell us about that. And also, do they activate different parts of the brain?
Yes, I would say so. So if you want to go through just very briefly the creative process that I used, and this wasn't my idea. This has been around for over a century based on what highly creative individuals of the past say is their process to get from zero to a creative product. And the first step is that you have to prepare. You have to gather knowledge and information, and the more broadly based your knowledge is, the more likely it is you will come up with novel and original combinations of information that you can use in creativity. So you want a broad knowledge base. Then you need specific skills in the area in which you're going to work. So, for instance, writers need to, you know writing techniques. Then, after you've gathered information and you have specifically developed skills, you need to come up with a creative problem. What is it that you're going to do with these skills? And creative problem finding is an interesting technique where you just scan the environment around you and what you know and try to find holes in it that you could improve. So once you've identified a problem, then you work on generating solutions to it. And generate a solution, evaluate it, generate a solution, evaluate it. You can consciously direct yourself to generate a solution. For instance, if we look at the way that Thomas Edison found the appropriate material for the filament for a light bulb. He just started going through different types of materials or different types of fibers that could be used for this, tried it, and discarded it. So the trial and error technique is the deliberate pathway. Now, other people will come up with their creative problem, think about it, mull it over, and then put it on the back burner of their brain while they go do something else. Eventually, an idea will spring forward into mind, so, sort of what we call the aha effect, and then they can evaluate that. So that's the spontaneous pathway, and that's the one that you use and that I tend to use as well.
You know, I find with that what really works is for me to kind of, you know, if I'm writing a piece, just kind of review it, my notes, the night before, just before I go to bed. And then when I get up in the morning, I can write it. Whereas if I try to write it, you know, if I have all my notes and I've been doing all the research and then I try to sit down and write this thing, I just get lost in the minutiae.
Right. So I think you've done the exact, you have used the spontaneous pathway. You've presented the problem to what I call the research and development part of your brain, which is back in the associational cortex, and then you have defocused your attention. You've left the problem and gone to do something else or gone to sleep. So sleep or rest, taking a walk, it's a good way to do this. For me, a hot shower, a long hot shower will sometimes do it. Anything that defocuses your attention. This allows more information and more ideas to feed forward into conscious awareness then, what we call the aha effect.
And we're talking with Shelley Carson. We're talking about creativity and how it happens and how we can help it along. Her book is Your Creative Brain. Now, you teach creativity, abnormal psychology, and resilience at Harvard University. What's the connection between these three different things?
Well, the way I got involved in the creativity work was even back as a graduate student. I'm trained, by the way, as a psychopathologist. So that's somebody who does research on mental disorders. And I was fascinated, even back as a grad student, with the number of highly creative luminaries, both past and present, that seem to suffer from inner demons, so to speak. And so I became very interested in trying to discover what was the connection between these inner demons and the ability to be creative. And that's how I got into creativity research. Then the resilience work, in my other life, I also work for the Department of Defense on a project called afterdeployment.org. And in this project, we are bringing mental health help in a completely online format to our returnees from Iraq and Afghanistan who are coming back with some mental health issues such as post-traumatic stress syndrome, depression, anger management problems, or even alcohol problems. And the work that I've done on resilience for that program is what led to my resilience course at Harvard.
Wow, that's so interesting then. And you're finding then these techniques are working with people?
There do seem to be some real cognitive behavioral skills that people can learn. So resilience can actually be taught, which is a wonderful thing. And now I'm working on a program where I combine both resilience skills and creativity skills to help people find more well-being in their lives.
Now, you mentioned writers before. I'm sure I'm not alone. I'm probably in the majority of writers in that there have been times when I've hit some major writer's blocks. What are some things people, writers, can do to overcome those blocks?
Well, the first thing you have to realize is that lots of times writer's block comes from trying too hard or focusing too narrowly on your topic. Also, and this is speculative, so I don't know whether specific research has been done to show this, but Kenneth Heilman has a theory that the neurotransmitter norepinephrine is involved in the ability to come up with creative ideas and also overcome creative block. And he suggests that the more norepinephrine you have circulating in your prefrontal brain, the less you're going to be able to come up with creative ideas because norepinephrine is a focusing chemical. It's associated, for instance, with being anxious. So when you're anxious, you hyper-focus on possible threats in your environment. And that's why we have it, why we have this norepinephrine in the brain, so that we can focus on threat in times of danger. So what you want to do is get rid of that. And the way to do that is to defocus your, rather than being focused, try to defocus your attention. And again, some of the ways you can do that are not to sit and keep looking at the blank page, because then you'll just get more anxious about it and
for sure.
Defeat your own purpose. So you need to get up and perhaps take a walk. Some people do well at meditation, so an openness meditation of some sort.
People sharpen their pencils.
Yeah, so, and some people have a little ritual that they will do that will put them into a defocused state of mind. So that's what I recommend, is that maybe you have a scented candle that you light, or a special type of herbal tea that you drink. And if you associate that with getting into a defocused mindset where the words will just kind of flow, then what you're doing is conditioning yourself to get into that brain activation state when you perform this particular ritual.
Now, you also talk about, you say the seat of creativity, or you're not sure about this, but you say you think it might be in the right hemisphere. Is that right?
That makes it too simplistic.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the right hemisphere is recruited in a number of different creative tasks, but in order to be optimally creative, you need to be passing information back and forth between the two different hemispheres. The right hemisphere, for instance, is specialized in many people for big picture ideas, whereas the left hemisphere tends to be associated with more details. So you need to be able to pass information back and forth between the two hemispheres. Also, novel information or unusual information usually recruits the right hemisphere. Right hemisphere is generally specialized for visuospatial information as well, whereas the left hemisphere for most people is associated with verbal learning, speaking, and understanding. So you need to be able to use both sides of the brain and recruit both to be truly creative.
Well, this is a wonderful book. It certainly, I think, would give hope to people who fear that they're not creative, and is a fascinating read for anyone. The book is Your Creative Brain, 7 Steps to Maximize Imagination, Productivity, and Innovation in Your Life. Thanks so much, Shelley Carson, for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me, Francesca.
Shelley Carson. Go to writersvoice.net for links to her Creative Brain website, where you can take a brain sets quiz, read about research on creativity, and find other creativity resources. You can also hear Shelley Carson talk about gifted and talented programs in the schools and what's happening to them in a web-only extra from our interview with her. Next up, Get It Done with Stever Robbins. Stay tuned after the break.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and to see all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly into the light of the dark black night.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Picture this. Say you've got a home office. You've just sat down at your desk and started in on the first task of the day, catching up on mountains of email. Everyone wants a response from you ASAP. Then the phone rings. It's a friend wanting to talk. She's breaking up with her boyfriend. Meanwhile, your quarterly taxes are due tomorrow, and you haven't even gotten started. How are you going to get it all done? Should you get it all done? What stays on the plate? What goes back in the cupboard? And how do you decide? Productivity expert Steve Robbins has written the book for you. He's been producing the Get It Done Guy podcast since 2007, and he's distilled what he's learned into a little gem of a book, from speed dating your tasks to naming your file folders so you'll actually know what's in them. The book is Get It Done Guy's 9 Steps to Work Less and Do More. I started out our interview by asking Steve Robbins why he started the Get It Done podcast.
Real reason or the socially acceptable reason?
Both. The real reason first.
The real reason is because I was getting bored in my job, and I already had a podcast called Business Explained, where I tried to be very serious and talk about lofty business ideas, and I wanted something that was more fun. I wanted an outlet for the more playful and enjoyable, the part of my personality that I like living in more. And when the opportunity came up, I chose a topic that was not the main topic that I spent most of my life dealing with, which is personal productivity. I've actually been a personal productivity devotee on my own, like, my whole life. But this was never a topic that I was known professionally for, even though it's something that I did. And so I said, oh, you know what, this will be a good way to get the topic out there, but more importantly, I can get it out there under a whole new persona, where I can be fun and playful and irreverent. And the next thing I know, the podcast hit number one in the business category of iTunes 3 weeks after I started it.
Wow.
So I suddenly discovered that my playful, fun business persona was in fact, which is how I would prefer to show up in the world anyway, turns out to be far more popular than all of the high, lofty, big idea stuff that I was doing previously.
Well, I have to say, your Get It Done Guy's 9 Steps to Work Less and Do More is a very engaging book to read. I laughed out loud at quite a few steps. I just want to ask you, what were you known for doing before?
Leadership and business, like entrepreneurship strategy. Most of my career has been spent doing on the business side of entrepreneurship. I have a Harvard MBA and thought that meant I had to go be a stuffy business person. And it turns out I was wrong, thank goodness.
Yeah, really. Well, this is a terrific book for somebody like me who tends to, you know, be more on the creative side and has struggles with organization quite a lot. Procrastination is one of my greatest problems, in fact. And I really enjoyed your tricks and tips on how to deal with it. For one thing, you say that we should speed date our tasks. What do you mean by that?
Absolutely. Well, you know, step two of my book is stop procrastinating. And speed dating tasks it's just like speed dating people, only without the body odor issues that sometimes come up at real speed dating, which is you make a list of the top 5 or 6 things that you're procrastinating. I would limit it to 5, generally speaking. And you get a timer. I use a timer that's on my BlackBerry, or I even have a separate egg timer that I can put on the desk next to me. And I literally use a timer. I do not trust myself any other way. And you hit the timer, and you start working on the first task. You set it for 5 minutes. As soon as the 5 minutes are up, you move on. Even if you're in the middle of a sentence, if you're a writer, which is one of the ways that I do writing, that doesn't matter. You move on to the next task, and you do this until you've done 5 minutes on all of your tasks. Then you give yourself a 10-minute break. So if you have 5 tasks, that'll be, you just spent 35 minutes total, and then you do it again. And then if you're really building momentum, the next time, instead of being 5 minutes, you do it for 10 minutes, and then you gradually lengthen the amount of time if that seems useful. And the idea behind it is that your brain, a lot of procrastination comes from your brain, and your brain thinking, oh my gosh, this task is going to be so big or so difficult or so onerous. But 5-minute chunks are so small that your brain can just go, you know what, it's only 5 minutes. No matter how obnoxious the task is, I can do 5 minutes on it. And so you find that most of your resistance gets eliminated, and you just get right into a flow and you start going.
What about for people like myself who find that we're spending an awful lot of time trying to get ready to do that task, a lot more than 5 minutes?
What do you mean, get ready?
Well, finding the things that we need to do, it, thinking what needs to be done first. You know, I'm afraid if I just put 5 minutes into things, I would just get confused.
Well, then maybe one of your tasks is to plan out the more complicated tasks you have. And so what you would put on the list is several things that are really obvious, things like fill out expense reports, say, or, you know, whatever does not require a lot of preparation. But then one of your tasks itself would be prepare for this big, honking, complex task that's coming up. And the other thing, when you have a five-minute time limit, you actually really get down to business. So if your task is prepare, and you know you only have 5 minutes to prepare, you actually will kick yourself into high gear and prepare more rapidly than you would think.
Now, are you talking about this 5 minutes a day, or are you talking about, you know, doing 5 minutes, a round of that, and then another round of maybe 10 minutes?
Oh, the latter. Do a round of 5 minutes, then a round of 10 minutes, then another round of 5 minutes, or 15 if you want to go, if you want to move up. But the idea being that what you want to do is cycle through all the things you're procrastinating very rapidly. And what will happen is your brain will discover that, A, it's not that big a deal after all, and B, since you'll be making a little bit of progress on every single item, suddenly you'll feel like, oh, wow, look, I'm going. Like, this is great.
And what are some other ways in which people can deal with a procrastination problem?
Well, one of my other favorite ones, and this is because I'm a fairly social creature, is to enlist the aid of a friend or friends. And I hold these things called action days, which I learned from the coaching community. And an action day, it's a very simple idea. You get together some friends, and you get a conference line, and there's a gazillion free conference services out on the web. Just Google free conference service, and you'll find a million of them. And what you do is you call in at the top of every hour, and every person says two sentences, no more, no less. They say, here's what I did last hour, and here's what I plan to do next hour. And you go around, you have a little roll sheet, and you just call each person's name, and then when you're done, you hang up and you go be productive. And by the way, you can get through 12 people in about 4 minutes if you really just focus on the two sentences. And there is something about forcing yourself to stop once an hour and check in with other people that really holds you accountable, even though there's no actual accountability. So, you know, you think, oh my gosh, you know, I've only got 5 minutes till the next check-in. I still haven't started that thing I promised people I would start. I don't want to show up and have to say to this group of people, I didn't do any work on it at all, so I'll do a little bit. And you start to get going, and then as soon as the check-in is over, you're already in the middle of it, and you just keep going. It's a very nice structure, and it's remarkably effective.
We're talking with Steve Robbins. He's the Get It Done Guy. That's the name of his podcast on the web. His book is 9 Steps to Work Less and Do More. Now, I'm going to go back to step one of these, because something you said before really resonated with that. You said, kind of at the top of our interview, you said that you had started out doing something that was making you very bored, and you decided you wanted to go into another side of your persona. So tell us about step one, and how is this an example of that?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, step one is, without step one, the entire book is not necessarily going to help you, because you'll spend your entire life, you'll spend all of your efforts optimizing the wrong parts of your life. Step one is live on purpose. And it's real simple. What it means is know why you're doing what you're doing and which of your personal and professional goals it links up to. And a lot of us think that productivity is about doing better at work. But, you know, two questions. One, why bother? Because doing better at work is not always a good idea, frankly. And I go into this a little bit in the book when I talk about how, you know, if you do better, you get more work assigned to you, and once you have more than a critical mass, anything that goes wrong in one area cascades to other areas. But more importantly, in my opinion, is that a lot of times we have personal goals and things we want to do with our lives as well. And we orient everything we do around what we think we need for work, and we kind of forget the rest of our lives. And in the Live on Purpose chapter, I lay out something called a life map, which, and by the way, virtually everything in the book I either currently do or I have done in the past. So it's almost all either from personal experience or I've tried it and know that the techniques work. The life map came out of me trying to explain my business to my summer intern 2 years ago. And I said, you know, my business doesn't make any sense unless you understand what my overall life goals are. And I drew out this map of my whole life and how all of my business initiatives fit into it. And I suddenly realized what a powerful, powerful tool that is. Because as new things came into my life, I could just ask myself, where on the life map do they fit? And if they didn't fit, that was a sign that as attractive as the thing might be, bringing it into my life would really mean essentially opening up an entirely new area of life, which is not inherently bad, but it's just a lot of effort and represents a big change. And I could ask myself, is doing this fun project, which I'm only doing for the fun, is that worth really kind of opening up a whole new area of my life? And sometimes the answer has been yes, and sometimes the answer is no.
You know, I have to say I found myself stymied right at this step. I know for myself, like a lot of people, we are overwhelmed with things that we have to do. And as you point out, there are other things that we really need to do to feed our souls. And it really seems that there's nothing that we can cut out. So what do you do in a case like that?
One of the things that I've certainly done in my life is hired a personal coach, which is what I used to do as a profession. That's one of the places that a lot of the material came from. And frankly, you can cut out any and everything in your life. Is the actual truth. Now you may end up living on the streets and begging for food, but the reality is, everything we tell ourselves we have to do, it's not true. We only choose to do it based upon what we believe the consequences would be of not doing it. And what I invite people to do, especially if you're putting together a life map, in the process of doing that, you will identify a bunch of things that don't link up to your top-level goals that you're only doing because you believe you have to. I would invite people to really challenge themselves and ask, do I really need to do X, Y, or Z? You know, I need to do this because otherwise my spouse will get upset with me. You know what? If I sit down with my spouse and I say, I'm spending all of this time doing this because I'm afraid you'll be upset with me if I don't, but this is eating into, you know, my ability to feed my own soul and do what I want to do with my life. Would you support me in not doing this thing anymore so that I can do the stuff that I really want to do? You know, your spouse may say yes.
Hmm.
And if your spouse doesn't say yes, all I can say is that, there is this whole thing about speed dating and moving on to the next one. But I'm just saying.
That's a dangerous territory.
Exactly. That's why this is a book on personal productivity, not dating.
Yes. Now, you also talk about technology. You know, I think a lot of us, myself included, use technology with the idea, sometimes mistaken, that it's going to help us do things in a more efficient manner. You actually put your to-dos on paper.
I do.
Why?
I do not use technology. I did something, and I talk about this in Chapter 3, which is Conquer Technology. I did something which I call a technology audit a few years ago, where I realized I was becoming addicted to all of my technology, and I didn't seem to be working any less. I just seemed to be spending all of my time on the technology itself. So I wrote down my hypotheses about why I was using it. And the main things were an electronic address book, to-do list, and calendar. And I really stopped and asked, what the heck? Like, you know, why do I have this online calendar instead of, I used to use a paper month-at-a-glance calendar. And I challenged myself to set out a period of time. Now, I did a full year, which is probably overkill. But for 1 year, I did everything online using my Palm Pilot at the time and et cetera. And at the end of the year, I stopped and did a review and said, okay, was this actually any better than doing it on paper? And what I found was, for my calendar, I still like the month-at-a-glance overview, which I can't get on a handheld device. So I do have my calendar online, and I have it synchronized with my handheld device, but I will also print it out a month-at-a-glance and use that to get the overview of my life. For my address book, hands down, online is better. So that I keep on my computer, and it synchronizes to all my devices, and life is wonderful. And with my to-do list, I discovered that anything, when it was entirely electronic, any time that the to-do items would scroll down past the bottom of the screen, I would just never scroll down. So everything past the bottom of the screen, I wouldn't look at again, and it would eventually get lost, especially because to-do items tend to accumulate, and over time I would get dozens of them, and then there would be so many I wouldn't even want to scroll down, even if I realized I hadn't scrolled down recently. And I just realized it wasn't serving me. Whereas with a paper technique, at the very least, when I fill up one sheet or one notebook or whatever I happen to be using at the moment, it forces me to go through and look at all the things that haven't been done and either reinstate them or decide, you know what, this isn't important to me anymore, I'm going to give up on it and drop the item. So the paper to-do list for me has been better because, A, I can see more of the list at once, and, B, it really forces me to go back and clean it up at regular intervals.
We're talking with Steve Robbins. His book is 9 Steps to Work Less and Do More, and it is a lot of fun to read. New brain research is showing us that we can't really multitask. We can focus on different tasks by switching between them, but that takes a toll on our efficiency. Robbins contrasts multitasking with flow.
Well, flow is when you get in the zone, and when time goes away and you're completely absorbed in the task that you're doing, in a really, really, you know, productive, focused way. Interestingly enough, a lot of our distractions take us into flow. A lot of people can play video games for hours and never notice that they're doing it. But the kind of flow that is useful is when you get into that same zone with whatever it is you're trying to achieve. So let's assume that we're talking about work here. So if you are a writer, for example, flow would be when you're just in front of the computer or the typewriter or your legal pad with your pencil, and the words are just coming, and you're just in there. You're not noticing the passing of time. It's just everything is effortless, and the work is almost doing itself. You just happen to be the conduit.
Okay, so what are ways that we can improve our flow?
Well, if you want to commit suicide, one of the best ways to do it is to walk up to somebody who's in flow, shake them on the shoulder, and say, you know, excuse me, could you help me understand this text message that someone just sent me? Interruptions are the enemy of flow.
Right.
And especially in the, just with all the norms we've been developing around instant messaging and email and so on, the best way to get into flow, or actually, I would say the way to beat the distractions that pull us out of that, is to turn everything off. Once upon a time, and it was even within my lifetime, if you wanted to do something, you just did it. And the only thing that could interrupt you would be a person coming in or a telephone call. And that was really easy. You would take your telephone off the hook, and you would close your door. And voila, you have the lack of distractions you need for flow. And because we didn't have computers conveniently on our desk providing any distraction we could want, it was relatively easy to just immerse ourselves in what we were doing without this distracting thing. So if you want the equivalent of that today is turn off your email notifications, turn off your instant messaging, close down every window on your computer except the one you're working on if you're on a computer. If you're not working on the computer at the moment, turn the computer off too. And remove all those distractions. If a person comes up and interrupts you, I love to do, and I talk about this in the chapter, Beat Distractions to Cultivate Focus, schedule your interruptions. So set aside a particular time of day, the same way a lot of people schedule their writing or schedule their thought work. Schedule a time of day for interruptions, like 3 to 4. And if somebody comes up and interrupts you before then, you say to them very nicely and politely, I'm actually in the middle of something, but I will be available to see you at 3. So could you check back then? Thank you. You don't actually give them the opportunity to say no. You make it very clear, that's when I'm handling interruptions, is during my interruption time. Now, of course, if there's an emergency, the building is burning down, yes, you interrupt what you're doing. But almost as a rule, interruptions that come from other people, it's because they are panicked about something, not because you should be.
Now, for those of us like myself who have ADD, I find that if I don't do something now when I think about it, I tend to forget about it. And that means that I'm constantly interrupting myself. And yet, if I don't, it just falls off the plate into the, you know, into the universe where I cannot retrieve it. What could I do?
Ooh, you want the little emergency pad that I keep on my desk at all times. I have a tiny pad of paper, a little 3x5 pad, which is only for those kinds of self-generated interruptions. And when I think, oh my gosh, I have this great idea for a funny story to put in my next Get It Done Guy episode, I just jot it down on that pad of paper and then go right back to what I was doing. Or if I think, you know what, I have to remember to renew the car registration, I just jot down renew car registration on that pad. Then, once I'm done with the focus activity that I'm spending my time on, then I go back and look at that list and decide which of these things do I want to work on now, which ones do I want to schedule in my calendar, and which ones do I want to add to my to-do list to get around to it as soon as I, you know, as soon as I get to that point on the to-do list. But if you actually act on your distractions when they happen, that's where you get derailed. And for me, putting them on paper is a great way to let them out of my mind, and I don't worry that I'll forget them because they're on paper, and I know that I'll review them as soon as I'm done with my current focus activity.
Now, Steve Robbins, how about organizing? We all have to organize our space, put things where we can remember they are, where they are, and put them in the same place. But how about organizing one's thinking? What are some ways in which, you know, maybe some general rules on that?
Sure. When I talk about organizing thinking, what I mean it in a few different ways. But one of the ways, for example, is when you're doing the same thing with a whole lot of different items. So, for example, I'm an adjunct professor at a college, and I have to grade a bunch of papers. When I'm grading papers, I'm going to be doing the same grading process on each one of the papers. What I do is I stop and take the time beforehand to think, what are the different steps that I have to do with a paper? First, I collect it, then I grade it, and then once I have done grading it, I hand it back. Sometimes if people are going to redo a paper, then I have to accept it again and then grade it again and hand it back again. And I create a file folder for each one of these steps. So the mental piece is really thinking through what are the steps that I'm going to go through with this over and over and over and over. And then on each file folder, I label one file folder, papers that have been turned in, and that's where every paper that comes in goes. And then once I've graded it, I put it in the these have been graded paper, you know, and it's time to hand them back folder. And then I have another folder of papers to regrade when I have the time. And any papers that come back to be regraded go into that. And then once they've been regraded, they go back into the folder that's papers to hand back. So I have three folders. And then just so that I don't have to think about it, I write on each folder what I should do with the things in the folder and where I should put it. So on the folder that is for incoming papers, I actually have written on the folder, grade the papers in this folder, and then put each paper in the folder that's labeled to be handed back. And that way, yes, I had to think that through once, but once I've thought it through once and I have embodied it in these file folders, I never have to think about it again. So it frees up my mind from worrying about, oh, do I know where my papers are? I always know where they are. They're in one of three folders.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. As I said, most of these techniques I invented for myself because I have tremendous difficulty keeping track of more than one or two things at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And when I invented this a few years ago, at least for myself, and I'm sure it's been invented at some point in human history, and it changed my life. Because suddenly I didn't have to worry anymore about, is this a paper that's been graded but not handed back, or was this one turned back in? You know, just every step of the process had a different folder, and I figured it out once and then just didn't have to think about it again.
This kind of goes along with another of the steps, and that's streamlining. I mean, here you thought it out once. I know with the getting it done philosophy, you're only supposed to handle a paper once. And I actually find that impossible because sometimes I have to look through the papers first, and there may be things that I can't take action on yet. You know, it kind of leads to another step. So there I am. I have to think about, okay, now where does this go where I know I've handled it once, but I still have to handle it again?
Yes. Well, you know, it's interesting because I've heard that business about only handle stuff once. And the only thing I can think is, who are these people? You know, like they obviously get a lot less stuff than I do that requires them to take a lot fewer actions because...
Right.
You know, there's stuff I get, like if I pick up a bill from my post office box and I'm not going home, and I do this when I'm cleaning, actually. I do this with bills. In fact, right now I have a pile of papers that must be dealt with that have no other place. And when I create a place like that, by the way, the critical piece of that is you have to schedule a time for yourself to go through that. Otherwise, those things get lost entirely. So you need to make sure that there's a memory hook, and for me, putting it on my calendar means it will get done. So right now, I have a pile of papers that are a combination of incoming faxes and paper mail and insurance claims or all that kind of stuff that are just in one big pile neatly in my office. I know exactly where it is. and I have a time blocked off on my calendar, which is going to be the hour that it will take to go through and figure out what to really do with these. Do they require action? Require being filed? Can I throw them away? I just didn't have time when they came in to deal with them. So right now they're in my to-be-dealt-with pile, which is neatly in the place where I know that it is, and it's on my calendar, so I know that I'll get to it.
So let's go to the last step, and that's leverage, which you say is the big mama of working less and doing more.
Yes.
Give us an example of that.
Well, one of my favorite techniques for leverage is to combine goals and find a single task that can move you towards multiple goals at the same time. So, for example, as I was writing my leverage chapter, I got a piece of paper, and two of my goals, one is I'm doing a book launch, and the other one is that for reasons I don't understand, but I'm sure they're deep and traumatic, I was suddenly hit by the desire last year to do musical theater, never having done it in my life. And I thought, well, darn, how can I do a book launch where I'm going to be spending all of my time talking in front of people when I also want to do musical theater, which requires a sustained commitment and practice and rehearsal and all that? And I thought about it, and I thought, wouldn't it be a hoot to do a musical about personal productivity? So a one-man musical based on my book. And, you know, I thought, okay, that's just too bizarre and too wacky and too out there. And I called a friend to tell him about the idea, and there was silence on the other end of the line. I was like, what's going on? And he said, Stever, do you know what I do for a living? And I said, yeah, you're a journalist. And he said, no, I teach musical theater composition at NYU, and I compose for Off-Broadway.
Wow.
And I said, you're joking. And he said, no. And I said, well, would you like to collaborate? And he said, I can't think of anything that would be more fun. So although it started as a wacky example for the leverage chapter, and I might add, it didn't actually make it into the book, it's becoming real. And it turns out, who knew, I have a talent for writing lyrics, and he is great at writing stories and at composing music. So we're co-writing the story. I'm writing most of the lyrics. He is writing the dialogue and the non-sung parts of the book. And he's composing the music, and I'll be performing it.
Oh, terrific. And do you have a name for it?
Right now, we're just calling it Get It Done Guy, the musical.
That's wonderful. Well, I look forward to that. Stever Robbins, your book is 9 Steps to Work Less and Do More. Actually, the full title is Get It Done, Guys, 9 Steps to Work Less and Do More. Thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You can find a link to Stever Robbins' podcast and blog at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests and see videos or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.